People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. I wonder if you were one of the lucky people to have been at a concert in the City Hall on the 15th of August when the National Youth Orchestra of Germany performed with their conductor Alexander Schelley. While they were here, I was lucky enough to catch up with Alexander. Immediately he got off the aeroplane and get him to talk to us a little bit about the orchestra and about his rather glamorous career with big orchestras and big soloists. And listen to this. People consider themselves lucky if they grow up with one piano in their home. But Alexander Schelley, the British conductor, has five, or his parents had five. And he says there's a reason for this. Both his parents, Howard Schelley and Hilary McNamara, were concert pianists and often gave concerts as a piano duo on two pianos, hence several practice rooms and several pianos. And apparently, Alexander, you learned to play the piano at the age of four. Welcome, and thank you for coming by so soon off your flight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's a major operation, isn't it, to bring an orchestra out? I mean, I know you didn't have to get worried with the logistics of it all, but apparently it's about 90 strong. Tell me a little bit about this orchestra, the German National Youth Orchestra.
Sure. Well, the German National Youth Orchestra in German is called the Bundesjugendorchester, so the Federal Youth Orchestra, and it is made up, as a general rule of thumb, of young musicians from around Germany between the ages of 14 and 19. And on this particular tour, we actually have a lower age of 16. So all the musicians, the 90 who are here, aged between 16 and 19. And it's described, they like to describe themselves as Germany's youngest top orchestra. And it is the God Orchestra, so the Godfather Orchestra of this orchestra is the Berlin Philharmonic, and they have very close ties. And what happens is three times a year, the young musicians come together. There's an audition process. Your first period of work with the orchestra is your probation period, and then there's a vote whether you've become a member or not, and then you tend to be a member for a few years. So it functions a little bit like a professional orchestra, but just, you know, for kids. Yeah. They do three sort of projects a year. And what that normally entails is some of the top orchestral musicians from around Germany coming in to do sectional rehearsals for a few days with the young musicians. And then a conductor comes in and takes over and does the full orchestral rehearsals and has a few days to work. And then you go off on tour. And either it's a tour of Germany or oftentimes, normally once a year, there's an international tour.
You seem to have done quite a few international tours to far-flung places as well.
Me personally, yes. This is my first international tour with the Bundesjugendorchester, although they came to Canada on my invitation, where I'm music director of the National Arts Center Orchestra. They came in November of 2018 for what I think was a really beautiful project. They sat side by side with my orchestra to perform on the 11th of the 11th, 2018, Britain's War Requiem, so the 100th anniversary of Armistice. And I thought that was a very powerful message, you know, Canada's national orchestra with Germany's national youth orchestra shoulder to shoulder. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. So that was them internationally.
And what a work.
And what
a work
of music.
To do for an occasion like that.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. And anyway, but this is my first international tour with the orchestra. I've done several tours of Germany with them, and it's a thrill. It's a thrill.
I'm sure it is. I see you celebrating, the orchestra celebrating its 50th anniversary. Mm. So the change in personnel must be quite vast over the years, because presumably at 19 they need to move on and go and do something else.
That's right. Actually, this year, because it's the 50th anniversary, musicians from around Germany in the different orchestras have been sending in videos to the National Youth Orchestra of Germany to say thank you. You know, in any of the top orchestras in Germany, there's always at least a handful of ex-members of this orchestra. I think the Berlin Phil has 12 or 13 members, something like that.
I wanted to ask you, Alexander, if you don't mind me interrupting you, about your relationship with the Berlin Philharmonic, mm-hmm. because I'm lucky enough to have a bit of a relationship with them. So do they, like, sponsor you? Do they mentor you? What sort of relationship is it?
Well, they have a close relationship with the National Youth Orchestra of Germany in that they invite them to, for example, when they're in residence in Baden-Baden, the youth orchestra will stay there and will do its own concerts, but they will train them, mentor them, play soccer with them. There's lots of, you know, a really close relationship building. And in Berlin as well, so the orchestra is at least once a year, and I think several times a year, the Philharmonie in Berlin. So there's a sense that the music director of the Berlin Phil, the orchestral members themselves, care deeply about how this youth orchestra develops and grows, and view themselves as mentors for the young musicians, which is beautiful.
Does the orchestra have a semi-permanent resident conductor? Is that you, or how do they work with conductors?
No, it's always guest conductors. So I've been fortunate enough to do several projects with them over the last few years. And, for example, recently Kirill Petrenko, the new music director of Berlin Phil, he did a project. Simon Rattle has done several over the years, as have many other fine German and international conductors as well.
So it obviously goes back to Karajan's day as well, possibly.
May do. I'm afraid I don't know the history deeply enough.
Too young you are.
Yes, I apologize for that. But yes, no, there's been a close link over the years.
Okay. Well, now I'm interested to know what sort of music you're going to choose, and I'm glad you've chosen some works that you've conducted. And I see you've chosen first the New World Symphony, the fourth movement of Dvorak 9, where you are conducting your orchestra in Canada, the National Arts Center Orchestra. Is there a particular reason you chose this, or is it a recording that you're particularly proud of?
Of course, that orchestra is now a major focal point of my life. I've been there since 2015, and we're having an absolutely wonderful time together. We commission an awful lot of new music, perform an awful lot of new music from Canada, and try to be a hub for, you know, Canadian creative artists. The National Arts Centre is a building right across from the Parliament building in Canada's capital, Ottawa. And within the building we have French theatre, English theatre, the world's first Indigenous theatre, National Theatre Company. We have the orchestra, we have ballet, we also have world music, pop music, folk. So there's a lot going on in the building. It's really an inspiring place to work. And that's why I mentioned the creative side of things first, because as music director of an institution like that, I ask myself, well, what role do we play in society? What role do we play if we have sort of funding from a central government as a national organization? I think first and foremost, we have an obligation to be champions of creative artists in the country. So I love that part of what we do. We tour, we give a lot of concerts, not we toured all around Canada in 2017 for the 150th anniversary of the country, and we just did a tour of Europe. But we're recording a lot, and currently we're in the midst of a Brahms-Schumann cycle, so the four symphonies by each of them, plus then a huge amount of music by Clara Schumann, gluing the CDs together. It's going to be exciting.
Okay.
But this was one of the first CDs I made with the orchestra, and I thought that it might be nice for some of the listeners to hear the orchestra. One of the objectives we have in the coming years is to broaden the awareness of the orchestra. It's an absolute gem of an orchestra. And I thought maybe From the New World, seeing as it's a New World Orchestra,
yes,
might be a nice theme. So I hope the listeners enjoy it.
part of the last movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony with the National Arts Center Orchestra conducted by Alexander Shelley, who is my guest on People of Note this week. And you will know that Alexander Shelley conducted the German National Youth Orchestra recently here in Cape Town in a concert at the City Hall, which opened the Cape Philharmonic Orchestra season. And it was great to see what 90 musicians. Is there a good spread, Alexander, between male and female? Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Among the orchestra,
I would guess it's 50-50, if not slightly weighted towards more girls in the orchestra than boys. It's funny, I was asking myself exactly the same question when I watched them taking the stage, and I didn't have time enough to count, but I should do that, because I see in the majority of orchestras around the world nowadays a very healthy gender balance.
Mm, yeah. There is, isn't there? From the old days where with the Vienna Philharmonic and the Berlin, you would never see a lady. Yeah.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning,
gentlemen.
In all
the rehearsals, they would say, yes. Yeah.
But so you spoke about the National Arts Center Orchestra in Canada, but I think you're also very involved with the Royal Philharmonic, aren't you?
Yes, I'm the principal associate conductor of the Royal Philharmonic, and I curate a series of concerts in London with them, and I tour with them in England and then internationally. And that's my other sort of musical family at the moment. They're an extraordinary orchestra as well. I mean, what London orchestras can do is no orchestras in the world can match in terms of getting to a very high level very quickly. Yeah. There's nothing like it.
It must be great. I mean, it's one of the great London orchestras with a fantastic history back to Thomas Beecham, isn't it? And a sort of really mainstream orchestra as well, the London Philharmonic, the Royal Philharmonic, the Royal Philharmonic.
Exactly.
And is there I've often wondered this, and perhaps this is not even a relevant question, is there a good sense of competition between the big orchestras in London?
There is. I think that there's a sense of competition. I think there's also a sense between the musicians of, you know, extended family. Mm-hmm. They all work incredibly hard. There's a lot of cross-pollination between the orchestras. So, you know, people go in and help out if someone's sick or missing. There is camaraderie between the players, but of course there's a jostling for position, and of course each of the orchestras has to think about how they position themselves. But it's a big pie, you know, there's a lot of people in London, and I think it's very exhilarating nowadays for all arts institutions to think about how to communicate with audiences. Yes, the world is noisier and more complicated, and yes, there's more draw on people's attention, but actually there's also more opportunity. There are more different ways to get your message out. So it can be a bit frightening, but I think it's also invigorating and exciting for people.
Yeah, I'm interested in that you said it's a noisy world we live in, isn't it? And these orchestras are also having to attract young people, and you seem to have a fairly interesting way of setting up programs. You have interesting projects, don't you, to attract people?
Well, I mean, I do that through lots of different avenues. I think that I mean, I'm a great fan of classical music, and I'm a great optimist. Firstly, it's 500 years of music, if not more.
It's incredible.
I mean, when anybody comes to me and says something like, oh, you know, classical music's not my thing, or something along those lines, I always sort of dig in and I say, I don't really understand what that comment means. It's like saying, well, books are not my thing, or literature's not my thing. It's sort of a nonsensical thing to say, because there is something in the world of classical music for everyone.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether it's a 2-minute waltz by Shostakovich from one of his jazz suites, or whether it's an hour-long Mahler symphony or a 4-hour-long Wagner opera, and everything in between. And mainly it's about the communication thereof. And I think there's also a danger of assuming that in order to connect with anybody, I prefer not to necessarily think generationally, although the conversation is often about young listeners, but any generation, just to connect with people, I think one mustn't be afraid of saying there are aspects of classical music that are complex, they're demanding. Like a great book can also be demanding. It's okay. And I think the more we shy away from demanding things, the more we cut off avenues of great joy for ourselves. And so I'm always an advocate for that. On the one hand, I say, listen, don't be scared. There's something in the world of classical music for everybody. And we'll find something and let's enjoy it. But let's also understand the urge that the composer had to write this piece. You know, it's always an expression of something.
Yes. And to communicate.
And to communicate. Yeah. And the beauty. And this is another reason that I often get frustrated when people think of a symphony orchestra as a vehicle of some kind of Western sort of expression of something, is that music of any culture has the beauty of being wordless, and it can therefore be comprehended by anybody else in the world, as long as your ears are open and your heart is open, you can take away from any music something. And, you know, symphonic music, we performing Brahms' Second Symphony on the tour, that is a piece of such human as well as musical and craftsmanship of such sophistication that it's the work of a lifetime to enjoy it and take it apart and understand it and internalize it. And that's hard. You know, it's not easy to get in there. But saying, well, because it's not immediately necessary for some people and for a lot of people accessible, we should avoid, you know, putting it in front of people. I think that's a terrible mistake to make.
Well, people know in this country that I am very anti the sort of dumbing down crossover thing. I know there's a place for crossover here and there, but I don't think that we should ever be shy of the great classics of Brahms too, for example.
Right.
And I'm lucky enough to be asked to do pre-concert talks and things. Mm. And the people that come along for a reason. They want sort of a few guides, a few sort of beacons to listen out for this theme or that theme or this effect or that effect. And it's aspirational as well, isn't it?
It is.
Which I think is a good thing for young people to look up to something and want to get to know it and understand it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, there are very, I find between most disciplines that humans engage in, there are generally very interesting comparisons. And something that frequently crosses my mind when I'm studying music is that there's the simplest sort of form, which is an ABA form, a statement of something else, and then a return to the original statement. It has a symmetry to it, a sense of journeying and then arriving home, which is very fundamental to the way that humans feel things. And a symphony is an expression of that over a far, far, far longer period of time. But it is also a manifestation of something that, you know, anthropologists and behavioral psychologists would talk about, which is the idea that the ability to think beyond the now and to think a week ahead, a month ahead, a year ahead, is something that's fundamental to how we build societies and cultures. You know, farming doesn't work unless you can say, I'm not going to eat that now. I'm going to plant it again, and I'm going to build, you know. And the idea that we don't teach children to immediately open presents they're given, that's also for a reason. It's to learn that some processes are longer, and that's the way we have to think about life. So, you know, there's quite apart from the just the wonderful sounds and music and the beauty of it, there's actually on a very deep sort of philosophical and human level, there is an importance and a beauty to long-form art, which we mustn't ever lose connection with.
I want to say hear, hear again, Alexander. Right, now your next piece of music features your two parents, Howard Shelley, Hilary McNamara, both of them concert pianists, and I've never heard this before, a piano arrangement of the symphonic dance of the first movement by Rachmaninoff.
Yeah, and it's his version. So he wrote this.
Did he do it?
Yes, yes, yes. This is his music, his version for piano. In fact, and this would be fun if listeners could correct me, off the top of my head, I think this came first and the orchestration came second.
So. Okay.
But well, please do call in furiously angry if I'm wrong, and I apologize in advance.
I'm sure it will be fine. Okay, let's listen now to Howard Shelley and Hilary McNamara. Thank you. part of the first movement of the Symphonic Dances by Rachmaninoff in, as my guest Alexander Shelley said, his own arrangement for two pianos, and featuring Howard Shelley and Hilary McNamara, who in fact are the parents of my guest Alexander Shelley, the British conductor who was in South Africa with the German National Youth Orchestra to perform at the City Hall. And we were all rather taken aback by this rather magnificent orchestra and the Brahms Second that you're talking about, as well as some other interesting works. But I want to find out a bit about you. Okay, you said there were five pianos in the house. You could perhaps possibly not ever not have taken up a music career. But I'm interested that you learned the piano, you learned the cello, but you were determined quite early on to go the conductor route. Mm. Where did that come from?
Yeah, that's an interesting
question. Unbelievable arrogance of conductors.
No, it was, I think, the short answer, it was a fascination with the sound of the orchestra. I remember touring with my father, including down here to South Africa, to Cape Town.
Oh, have you been here before?
I've been here
with your father.
When I was a kid, and some unbelievably fond memories. I was very young, so excited to go up Table Mountain, go to the beach, and enjoy this beautiful city. I just... Very, very fond memories. But I toured a lot with him when I was a kid and heard a lot of magnificent orchestras live, you know, in rehearsals and then in the concerts. And I was always very drawn to the music as well. I like to sort of relate the story that my parents, they would always give me, you know, cassettes to listen to when I went to sleep. I'm that old. And I would very, very often ask to listen to orchestral music, Beethoven symphonies, Mahler symphonies, you know, Scheherazade, whatever stuff. I found it incredibly evocative. And so, yes, I studied the piano and I studied the cello, which was my main instrument. But already at the age of 14, when I was at school in London, I asked if I could conduct the orchestra, and I was composing a little bit. And, you know, I was just a kid who loved music, and I was doing all the things, probably all of it very badly, but I was trying to, you know.
At least you were doing it.
Exactly. And anyway, I asked to conduct the orchestra, and they said I could, and I conducted Haydn's 104th Symphony and Mozart Flute Concerto, and I was sort of caught with the bug. And then I decided to go to Germany to study cello, and once I got there to Düsseldorf, I actually founded a chamber orchestra. It was on the advice of my father. He said to me, you know, if you're genuinely interested in conducting, then there's no better way to start learning the craft than to form an orchestra, an ensemble, and to work with them. And this was before I'd studied conducting. But I did that. I founded an orchestra, and in retrospect, one of the great advantages of doing that from a learning perspective was that I couldn't really offer my friends at college any money. We started to do then concerts, and we built it, and we did start to earn some money from it. But to begin with, I just had to find a way of working that felt inclusive and inspiring, and where we operated as a team, and to try and help us build that capacity. And of course, looking back, That was a very good bit of training for general life as a conductor, because
they probably helped you as well.
Absolutely.
And said, don't do this or try that, or
absolutely.
No, we're not following you, or
absolutely.
It's not working.
Absolutely.
Try this.
And there's a general sort of way of saying, in the old days, conductors were dictators and now they have to be collaborative. I don't really buy that. I don't think it was ever that simple. I think some of the greatest conductors of the last generation had very good relations with their musicians and did understand very much how to create a sense that everyone was pulling in the same direction. And similarly, nowadays, you have to, for want of a better phrase, crack the whip sometimes. It's just human nature. Large groups of people, they go through sort of waves of concentration, waves of focus, waves of everything else. And so conductors have to have all those strings to their bows. But yes, I from nature am more at home in a setting where I feel like we're all on the same page and we're all working for each other. Mm-hmm. So that was great. Yeah.
But you won a conductor's competition, didn't you? The 2005 Leeds Conducting Competition.
That's right.
I want to read what the judges said here. The most exciting and gifted young conductor to have taken this highly prestigious award. His conducting technique is immaculate. Everything crystal clear and a tool to his inborn musicality. I think, may I say, that that's an incredible compliment.
Oh, that's...
Because inborn musicality, I presume a conductor absolutely has to have, apart from any arrogance or ego, but also the technique that the orchestra needs from you. Mm. And therefore, conducting a youth orchestra must also be quite an experience. It's not the Royal Philharmonic, but I bet you they put you through your paces.
Yeah. For me, the job of conducting in terms of the way I approach it psychologically, is quite straightforward, in that I am responsible really to one person, and that's the composer. I am his or her representative, and I need to ensure that we on stage give the best possible reading of his or her music. And I find that is a wonderful kind of cloak of confidence, because if you do your preparation rigorously and honestly and earnestly, and you know the score very, very well, then you also know what it is that the composer has created, the craftsmanship behind it, and you will have an honest idea of what it is trying to express. No one person will ever embody all the different areas of expression that, for example, a Second Symphony of Brahms has, because there are then different ways to accentuate what is being said. But if you've done your work correctly, you should be getting to very close to the heart of the matter. And the beauty is then when you're standing up there, it's not, well, this is Alexander Shelley's version, and I know everything, and I'm the best, and you better listen to me. It's rather, I have earnestly and diligently studied Brahms's music, and I believe, to the best of my knowledge and training, that this is what he's trying to express. This is how we bring it to life. And you end up being then very true to what's on the page. I think it was Picasso who said that an artist spends their life trying to draw a perfect circle, and the deviations from the circle express their artistry. Now, he was talking about creative artists, but I think that that's very true of interpretative artists, that if you try to do something different before you've really got to the core, the essence of the work itself, it's always going to be superficial. And in fact, if you just try and get to the text as close as you can, by virtue of the fact that you look through your eyes, you listen with your ears, that your analytical mind is your analytical mind, you will automatically have your own interpretation, but you're never trying to interpret. What you're trying to do is be honest to the piece. And I hope I'm expressing myself clearly, because they're two quite fundamentally different approaches. And so I understand that when you see a conductor on a podium, for many people it is the sort of definition of an expression of power, and it's also the definition of an expression of kind of ego and arrogance. But I think that when you're there, I believe if you're doing your job correctly, it is none of those things. It's a position of service, both to the musicians, to the audience, and then to the composer.
Gosh, there's some food for thought while we listen to your next piece, one of the great pieces in the repertoire, Beethoven's C minor symphony number 5, and you've chosen the finale, I think, the fourth movement, yes, from the March. Yeah. But I'm interested in the version you've chosen, because as we know with Beethoven, there's so many versions, mm-hmm, and you've chosen an interesting version, the German Chamber Philharmonic, Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie, yeah, in Bremen with Paavo Järvi. Mm-hmm. And what I like about his Beethoven cycle is he's taken the so-called period instrument approach, mm-hmm, with a modern orchestra, mm-hmm, in a sense, mm-hmm, and given it that crispness and attack. Mm. Do you agree? Is that one? Or why did you? I'm telling you what's.
No. You're absolutely right. I agree. I mean, it's an orchestra that's very close to my heart, with whom I worked for many years, and I think that's an interesting discussion. I'm of that school, and I think it's perhaps also nowadays a generational thing. Who believe very much that the metronome markings, for example, that Beethoven put there, were what he meant. And that if you sort of recalibrate, if it's something one's not used to, if you recalibrate and allow yourself to go there, but really commit, then even an 8 or a 9% difference feels like a huge relaxation, a huge ability to breathe within the music, and yet you're much closer to it. And it forces you to also, as you mentioned, articulate, to create sound in a way that then allows the expression to come to life within that tempo. So yes, it remolds it, it reforms it. And I think, finally, a final thought on this, that there is now a generation of musicians that's grown up for whom period performance praxis was absolutely, it was not a sort of bombshell, something new or something controversial. It was just there. It was just life. You listened to it, you appreciated it, alongside the other conception. And I think where there was once two schools that were maybe combating one another, and you were either in one camp or the other, I think it's been assimilated, it's now part of the musical DNA, and this record is an expression of that.
Well, there's part of that magnificent final movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, and played by the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie, conducted by Paavo Järvi. And that cycle, as I said, of the nine symphonies with Paavo Järvi is well worth listening to. The third choice of my guest on People of Note this week, the British conductor Alexander Schelly, who was in town recently to conduct the National Youth Orchestra of Germany. And one of the things about that concert, and I suppose this happens, Alexander, when you do tour, is you get perhaps new pieces, and Hendrik Hofmeier challenged you a bit, didn't he, with his four Sangoma songs. Mm. Did he send this three Sangoma songs, did he send them over to you to study, or did you think, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this, or do you like being challenged like that?
Well, they're actually very straightforward scores. The music is utterly sort of approachable. They're constructed in very simple form. The outer movements are basically just call and response themes. And the middle movement is a beautiful lament congo by a mother who's lost her child in a flood. And that's a melody that just simply repeats. So it's fairly, in a positive sense, I mean, there's repetitive music. It's simple, it's folky from that point of view. And all he's done is embellish with some somewhat sort of interesting alterations of harmony. And also he has, in the last song, he has contrasted, he's basically got two different episodic rhythms going on top of one another, overlaid. But it's deeply sort of accessible, very well written, and actually it's not a challenging score at all.
It was interesting, wasn't it, that you put in the Walton Johannesburg Overture, because isn't that fun? I mean, he even creates a sort of African feel in the middle of it with, I think, marimbas or something.
Yes, when he was asked to write the overture for the Johannesburg Festival, he apparently said he would be happy to do it, but he'd like to know more about African music, and he had them send him recordings, and he researched a little bit. And he found a song that he enjoyed, Masanga is called, and he quotes that directly in the piece. Yeah, so that's actually sort of the building block of the piece, and he takes elements of the musical DNA out and creates the rest of the overture. So, you know, that's very sort of honest from that point of view. He didn't want to just sort of turn up and write something purely English. Yeah. And yeah, it's a great piece. It's a lovely way to open the concert, and the musicians are enjoying it. And so we do that, then we do the Hofmeier songs with Masaki, this wonderful singer from South Africa, who's been such a joy to have with us. And the songs originally were written by Miriam Makeba in these versions, although they're traditional African. And then we have Porgy and Bess Gershwin, the symphonic suite, which is also a great thing for the orchestra to get.
Did he make up, did he do the suite, Gershwin?
No, it was Russell Bennett who did it, yeah.
Okay.
And it's an excellent selection, and it's not chronological in any sense. It's basically a symphonic suite that takes ideas and jumbles them up in a big puzzle and then spits it out the other end as a sort of 24-minute suite. But you have a lot of the great tunes, and actually, interestingly, a lot of the very good music from the opera, which is not particularly famous. So not all of the big tunes are there, but Summertime, Bess You Is My Woman Now, that sort of stuff is there. But also the hurricane scene, things like that. So it's great.
And then there's Brahms. Did you say earlier, Alexander, that you've just recorded the four Brahms symphonies with your
orchestra
in Canada?
Yes, we're mid-recording. So we've got symphonies 1 and 2 by both Schumann and Brahms in the can, and then 3 is this season, 4 is the season after. So we're going to be releasing 4 sets of double CDs, each with the first, second, third, fourth symphonies, and then gelled together with music by Clara Schumann. And Jan Swofford is working with us, the great musicologist, to sort of talk about the relationship between these three individuals.
Yeah.
And you know, what an extraordinary woman she was, performing all around Europe, writing music, lots of kids. I don't know quite how she did it. And she must have been such a compelling and fascinating and brilliant person to have drawn the love and admiration of those two people, of Robert Schumann and Johannes Brahms, who obviously had brilliant minds and brilliant hearts. So she's an inspirational figure, and I'm looking forward to us in our cycle exploring her a little bit more. Yeah.
Absolutely. I hope we're going to get some copies.
Yes,
here quite soon. Because the Brahms symphonies, aren't they amazing as well? Okay, you've just done the second, which is, I don't know, that lovely, almost pastoral symphony. Mm. And a lot of people say to me that the third is one of the most tricky to conduct, mm-hmm. and can be the most elusive. And then there's the great fourth. Mm. Or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they're all extraordinary. Brahms is, I mean, I find one falls in love every week as a conductor with whatever one's conducting. But
yes.
I I can't really think of a greater composer than Brahms.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that. Adrian Bolt famously said when he was asked which his favorite Brahms symphony was, he said the one I'm working on. Which says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Alexander, what about opera? Do you do much opera?
I don't do a lot of opera, but I do conduct opera. It's been now a couple of seasons. It was been quite tricky with what I was at one point, you know, still in Nuremberg as music director, then in Canada as music director, and then with the Royal Philharmonic for 2 years. So it's very difficult to sort of plan anything. But no, I've conducted opera actually since the beginning of my career, and I love doing it, and it's very much part of the plans for the future. It's the most glorious art form when it when it comes together.
Well, when it comes together, yes. And all the egos on stage are sorted out. The reason I ask you that is because I see we're about to end the program and you've chosen Richard Wagner, which I'm very pleased about, but we'll get back to that in a moment. The one question I've been meaning to ask you and I keep forgetting is when you are touring like this with the National Youth Orchestra of Germany, for example, presumably all the work is done in Germany. The whole program is prepared. So when the orchestra arrives here, they set up and you just have a sort of balance rehearsal possibly.
Yeah, actually, I mean, in theory, yes, but actually every single rehearsal on tour, sound check, I've been rehearsing. So we generally have an entire hour and a half sound check, which is unusual. Most orchestras would just do half an hour. And I quite often elongate that to 2 hours because, you know, for example, with a Brahms symphony, there is actually no end to the work, the level of detail and the refinement that one can bring, because like few other composers, he demands of an orchestra that it is on the one hand genuinely symphonic and you produce a big, rich, rounded sound, but his command of counterpoint is such that you have to, even when all the strings are playing, you have to be aware of the voice of the second clarinet or the second oboe. They will have an integral part in the soundscape, and is a very, very almost elusive trick that orchestral musicians have to work on, to on the one hand produce sound and not hold back, and yet have a transparency that allows those voices to come through. And that's a never-ending job. Mm. And his, you know, his voicings for woodwind and horn and low brass, they're always exceptional, and they're always challenging to really get it perfect. So and I must add briefly that the great joy of working with a group like the National Youth Orchestra of Germany is that they're fine. They want to work. They want to learn.
They want to learn.
They never say, oh, let's not do a rehearsal. They want it. So it's lovely.
And also with Brahms, isn't there? I mean, with his great love of Bach, the clarity of orchestration is so important. There was that period when it was very sort of heavy and romanticized. Yes. And there was that lovely quote, I forget who said it, that Brahms was a classicist trapped in the romantic era. Mm. Because his, as you just said, his counterpoint, his polyphony, the string writing is extraordinary.
It's very interesting. It's a very interesting fact that between Schumann finishing his four symphonies and Brahms writing his four symphonies, the entire Ring cycle was written. So that's quite an astonishing fact. So in the context of the entire Ring cycle being out there and that sound world, Brahms then decides to write the symphonies that he wrote, which are not in a sort of traditional sense bombastic or anything like
that.
Not at all. There's the absolute definition of refinement. And you can understand when you think about it like that why many people said these aren't symphonies, this is sort of chamber music for lots of people. I mean, I couldn't agree less. They're the most magnificently conceived symphonies. But yes, it's a very, very interesting sound world, and I find it unbelievably rewarding and unbelievably elusive at the same time.
And now you must tackle Beethoven. 9 symphonies with you. Now look, we're going to have to stop. I could go on talking to you forever, Alexander, but we need to stop. And I mentioned Wagner. You've selected something very special here, the Liebestod from Tristan und Isolde, but in that amazing recording with Carlos Kleiber and the Staatskapelle Dresden with Margaret Price, who never ever sang the role on stage. Mm-hmm. I presume you've chosen it because you think it's a marvelous recording.
I do. And I think, I mean, I'm a huge Kleiber fan, as a lot of people are. I'm a huge Wagner fan. I'm a huge fan of Tristan and Isolde on so many levels. And I'm a huge Margaret Price fan. It's such a great idea to have this voice sing this role. And it's very unusual timbre of voice. And so I thought it would be a lovely opportunity for us to all enjoy it.
Alexander Shelley, it's been great talking to you, and it's been great to meet you. And I hope you're going to enjoy Cape Town in South Africa, because you're visiting Durban, I think, and Johannesburg, and that you get to see some of the beauties and some good weather and some good wine here in Cape Town.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's listen now to Wagner. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hi, this is Peter Dirk Ace. My new show, Hashtag He2, is at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay from the 28th of August to the 14th of September with me and Evita Posada together on stage at the same time. Listen, I'm whispering because she's outside the door. And if she hears, she'll also want to talk to you. And you know, once she starts, she can never stop. So go book a CompuTicket now before she gets in the public protector. And oh, hell, here she is. Hello, Danny.